Hi, I'm Jocelyn Beal.
Hi, I'm Charlie Yvonne Simpson.
Hello, everyone. I am Dominique Mariso.
Hi, I'm Chisa Hutchinson, and you're listening to the Call and Response Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Call and Response Podcast with Felicia Fitzpatrick. Okay, y'all, so I don't really need to get into the details of it, but please just know that I went home this weekend, I tried on my junior prom dress, and it still fit. Okay? And it got me thinking about how I didn't really like my junior prom because it was at the zoo, and we all know that I'm not really an animal person. However, it turns out that there is an event that might get me back. It's the Bronx Zoo's Brew at the Zoo. They've got wine, they've got beer, they've got food. What more do you really need, right? Gold Star has suggested it for my event of the week, and as y'all know, it is only the beginning with Gold Star because they've got theater, comedy shows, concerts, and so much more. So download Gold Star and let's make some memories, y'all. And I know, every week I'm like, I'm so excited, I'm so hype, I'm so thrilled. And then I acknowledge that I'm so hype, I'm so thrilled, I'm so excited to introduce that week's guest. But y'all, there's some dope ass artists out here, and that's why I'm so excited to talk to all of them. So you're just gonna have to deal. This week is no exception. She's got a lot of awards, so I need y'all to buckle up while I read this list aloud. She has won a GLAAD Award, a Lily Award, a Lanford Wilson Award, a New York Innovative Theater Award, Helen Merrill Award, Paul Green Award, has been a LARC Fellow, Dramatists Guild Fellow, Humanitas Fellow, maybe? Yes, I pronounced that right. Second Stage Resident, so many more accolades. She's all over the place in the best way. It's Chisa Hutchinson, y'all. Give it up.
Hi.
I told you that was going to be an extra as hell intro.
It was extra.
But like, I wanted to celebrate you because you're killing it.
Okay.
She's like, maybe, Felicia. No, I'm so excited to talk to you today because I want to hear all about your body of work and your process as a writer. But I also got to see Proof of Love.
Yay.
And so we're going to talk all about it. The first question I like to ask, though, to get started is, how did you get involved in performing arts?
Oh, okay, so this is easy. I actually didn't even really see a professional theater production until I got to high school. And high school was, I was a scholarship kid at this very swanky private school in Summit, New Jersey.
Ooh.
And amongst all of the opportunities and resources that they had, there was a theater.
Gotcha.
And a really, really badass drama teacher named Mr. Pridham.
Shout out to Mr. Pridham.
I love Mr. He passed recently, so that was that broke my heart. But I shout him out every chance I get still because I know he's watching.
Yes.
But yeah, Mr. Pridham really had this very sort of holistic approach to, and it wasn't just about like, oh, here's a script, like do a monologue from it. Let's have it. He was like, no, we need to go out and see some stuff. Yeah. I'm going to take you to see, he took me specifically to see August Wilson debate Robert Brustein on the issue of colorblind casting like 18 years ago.
Yes.
And I was riveted.
Right, of course.
Right. And I found myself gravitating toward August Wilson's point of view of, you know, this whole colorblind casting thing is really just an excuse to not do stories that are actually by people of color and specifically for people of color. So can we not?
Right, you know? Right, right.
And I was like, right on. Because I, at that point, had played, I was acting as like the gateway activity, you know?
Yeah.
So I had played all these characters who were totally inappropriate for me as a young black girl, you know? It was then that I began to sort of understand and recognize the need for stories that are specifically about people of color. And,
right. Well, it goes beyond casting is what you're saying. Like, we need to have more writers of color. We need to have more directors of color that are telling new perspectives and new stories.
Yeah.
I love that. Shout out to August Wilson. Like, yes. So who were your other influences and inspirations as you were growing up?
I still feel like I'm growing up.
You still feel like you're growing up.
I mean, chief among them. Okay. Yeah. Well, Susan Laurie Parks. Lynn Nottage is probably my absolute favorite, just like maybe theater person, period, mm-hmm. or definitely one of my favorite just people, just like all time people. Yeah. She's a mentor. Like, I got to be her assistant when I was in grad school. So that was just like,
wow.
Yeah, man. She's like one of the coolest people and so humble and really generous, mm-hmm. With her time and her advocacy and, her gifts.
What was the first play of Lynn's that you read? Do you remember?
Intimate Apparel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
And I was like, who is this woman?
Right.
What else can I read by her?
Yeah. You know?
And then when I got here and I got to see Ruined and what else did I see? I'm such a fan. I've read all of her, like all of her stuff, you know? And then what else? By the way, Me Vera Stark, I saw the original version at Second Stage. And then
have they done Crumbs from the Table of Joy here in a minute?
You know what?
I'm like,
I don't think so. But I got to do a radio adaptation of that for her.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
that's
just
so
to like
cool.
go through and tweak the script and you know, anything that wouldn't sort of translate because it's visual or whatever. Right. I had to figure out how to like
make it work for the
audio. it work for the radio.
Wow.
I am shook. Like, I can't even imagine finding out that you get to assist Lynn Nottage would be amazing, especially if you've looked up to her for so long.
Oh my God. Like, I totally thrust myself on her.
You did? No, good for you.
I did. because I was at NYU.
Okay.
And it was, we were coming up on internship time.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, I want to go work for a company and make copies. And I said, it'd be much more helpful if I could just like follow around a working playwright that I admire.
Totally.
And it just so happened that one of her good friends, who's also a awesome playwright and advocate herself, Diana San.
Yes.
Yeah.
they're very good friends. They live like a block and a half from each other in Brooklyn, right?
Oh my gosh.
So she was teaching my master class.
Oh wow.
And I approached her very meekly and was sort of like, so you're friends with Lynn, right? Do you think she would be interested in having an intern for a semester?
Nice.
Maybe, perhaps.
Yes.
And she said, yeah, I'll ask. And like, who's gonna turn down like free help, you know? Like, so Lynn was game, and that's cool. And then I got it cleared with Richard Wesley was the head of the playwriting department when I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so cool. They're so flexible there. I love NYU because they're like, yeah, make of this experience what you will. And, you know, if you have a production and you need to go do something, okay, we'll work it out. We'll work it out.
Right.
So, I said, is this okay? Can I do this as an internship? And they were like, yeah, sure. That's fine.
What a dream come true. So what was what do you think the biggest thing you took away from that experience was?
I think, you know what? Okay, so I signed up to be her assistant like a couple weeks, I think, before she won her first Pulitzer, right? Because she has to.
Oh my gosh.
So so she became like the busiest woman on the planet, which means I became the busiest
woman on the planet as well.
On the planet
as
well.
Yes.
But even that, like even that experience and even that mile, you know, achieving that milestone didn't she was never complacent about it.
Mm-hmm.
She was never sort of like, oh, and now I can like just kind of chill out and everything I do is going to be considered genius and you know, she really continued to work hard, and I was really actually kind of touched. I'll never forget. Oh, I hope she doesn't get mad at me for sharing this. But I remember her being vocalizing some dismay at like not. I think it was Vera Stark that wasn't going to move to Broadway, there was something, some little something that was sort of like, man,
yeah.
I want a Pulitzer and I still can't get to Broadway,
right.
kind of a thing. And I was like, damn, like even the best of the best, you know, like even the best of the best are still sort of like, you know, have those goals that they want to reach. Right. And they feel some kind of way, like no matter how much they have achieved, you know, there's still that hunger. There's still that.
Yeah.
So that was my big takeaway of like,
was, you know, you're never going to be able to rest on your laurels. And
right. Even Lynn Nottage has got to keep pushing.
Even
so
Lynn
do
Nottage,
I. Man. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really got to hustle.
Well, so then when was the first time you felt like you identified as a playwright?
This is going to sound real, I don't know.
Uh-oh.
Maybe like oily or capitalistic, something. I don't know. This is going to sound real wrong, but like literally the first time I signed a contract.
That's fair though.
With a
that's
theater.
Real.
Because that's
real.
That's sort of, it just felt like a real sort of official acknowledgement of hey, this is a thing that people value enough to give you money. And not that money is like, you know, obviously, like
right,
I actually
right.
make more money as a writer now than I have at any day job that I've ever worked.
Interesting.
And I still don't, you know, that doesn't, it's not about that. It's about feeling like whatever the measure is, feeling like people value what you do or have use for what you do, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So much so that they're willing to exchange something that will, you know, buy you some food and
pay that rent.
Pay your rent, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah.
I would say the first time I got contracted to, you know, actually got paid.
Right.
To be a playwright, which, right. Again, sounds a little sleazy, but.
But it makes sense too, though, because it's that external validation, which, yes, I know is not good, but it's like when you're pursuing a career, like that's stuff you got to take into account.
Yeah, well, and it is a mark. I mean, it is a how do I put this? It's just it's not even so much about like, oh, how much can I make on this? You know, it's just more about like, oh, someone somewhere thinks that my words on the page are like useful enough to exchange something
I
for,
see.
You
yeah,
know, or,
yeah.
or, I don't know. Like, I don't know how to describe it.
I think that makes sense, though.
Yeah.
It does.
Okay.
And you've written a lot of plays, and you have signed a lot of contracts, which I love. Like, you're like it's amazing. I'm just looking at all of your work earlier on your website. There were so many that, I mean, I haven't seen, and I was like, I need to get a copy of that. Or, like, I need that to be produced somewhere so I can go see it. And I was curious, too, when I was reading, like, what – is there a theme to what sparks an idea for a play for you?
Oh, you know, I guess this is still true. When I had to describe the common denominator, or like what my work is, what the kernel is,
yeah.
the common kernel,
yeah.
I would say that it's about, I like to write about the ways in which majorities screw minorities over. And that's not just a racial thing.
Okay.
That's a sexuality thing. That's just like a sort of general culture thing. It's a classism thing,
sure.
as in Proof of Love.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
A gender thing. It's it takes a lot of different forms. Yeah. And I don't really like to rub, you know, the minority faces in their own victimhood, you know. So I try to make it so that there is some sort of defiant, like, claiming of power in the face of whatever forces
yeah.
are
trying to, like, oppress them.
Yeah,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, and for Proof of Love, it's like,
with it being a solo show, we have the specific lens that we're experiencing the story through, and yet by the end of the play, we do get to hear from the mistress character in her own words of how she's feeling about the situation. Mm-hmm. So it is kind of this reclamation of and kind of humanizing a, I don't even know if trope is the right word, but the idea of the other woman, like it's often like, oh, she's in the wrong, like, da da da. But no, we get to hear her side of the story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I just like went on like a 10-minute ramble because I was trying to figure out my question. So I guess then what is your writing process like? Like, does dialogue come to your head first? You're like, oh, I'm going to write it chronologically and go that way? Chronologically of the play?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually pretty boring in that sense. Well, because
boring.
I'll, like, think of a character, and maybe I'll think of a general situation. Okay, here's this woman. Oh, her. And, you know, this actually, I didn't, like, just create this out of thin air. This actually happened to my mom.
Proof of love story.
Pretty much. I sort of drew from a few different. I used some elements of her experience mm-hmm. in it, but she really did actually find out that her husband was having it, as a lot of women have, you know, found out that her husband was having a years-long affair. And this is something that I don't really do, like, dysfunctional family dramas or any, like, I'm not going to, like, name titles or anything, but I've seen so many plays that are sort of characters, they're unhappy in their marriage and, you know, and it's sort of problems of their own making in a way, or just sort of very limited to themselves. And I typically don't like focus on that stuff. But in this case, I really felt like it was the way in to this character was to sort of plop her into the middle of a kind of typical or almost cliched, as you said, that trope, you know, of
right,
like,
yeah,
of the
me versus the other woman kind of thing.
Right. So I wanted to plop her into a very familiar human
experience,
right? But then use that as a vehicle for sort of dealing with these more with sort of bigger social issues, right? With this sort of her behavior and her attitudes have these socio-political implications that that I'm not sure people would be open to necessarily if the vehicle weren't so human, you know. Of here's a very human story, a woman who's just found out her husband is cheating and you know, and is trying to sort of reckon with that. But over the course of that, I'm just gonna drop in some just gonna drop in some class bombs or
truly
some race bombs, some
that it brings up an interesting point too. So I guess we're just gonna dive into Proof of Love, like, fuck my structure. So in media, like, we're often just presented one black experience, you know what I mean? And like you said, you're dropping race bombs, like, oh, it was busting the black monolith of black experiences. Like, there can be more than one type of black person. Like, it's a surprise for some people for
it
some
is,
reason. But, like,
apparently,
you know, she, it did bring up this idea of, like, class even within, like, the black experience, you know? So, I was curious about that. What was it like writing this kind of, like, waspy, I guess, for, like, a better term, even though she's black, lens? And writing about this other black experience as well, and the relationship of those two.
It's so bizarre. Like, I guess I feel like I am a bit like Constance is the name of the main character, the wife. In a lot of ways, you know, I am a bit of a stickler about grammar. you know what I mean? Just little stuff. I am a tea snob. Just stuff like that, that, like, I have sort of, I guess, cultivated some kind of, like, bougie habits or whatever,
right, you know.
but I fully acknowledge that. And also, I fully acknowledge where I come from, you know? Like, I come from a hood where, you know, where majority of the people still say axe. Or say axe, and that's cool. Like, whatever, it's fine. You know, I know what you mean.
Right.
Who just, you know, for folks who just have different priorities, and it's not, and it's, I think, for people who haven't experienced both worlds, you know, like I have, you know, the sort of more, like, real working class, you know, acts take for granted, you know, you know, Jerry Springer episode, who the baby daddy, you know, it's so interesting. I just have so much to say, but like, I had a foot in that world, and then, like, but also, like, I went to Vassar, you know, I have an MFA, you know, I have a house and, you know, and a husband, you know, like, and it's, yeah, like, I have a kind of a bougie existence now, for, you know, for all intents and purposes, like, you know, but I don't forget where I come from. And I'm always sort of reminded, particularly because my husband is, he grew up pretty solidly middle class. He had grew up with both parents. I did not, you know, in a nice house. Both of his parents were like professionals, you know, one dentist, one nurse, you know, like very, very, a very sort of all-American family, you know, and, you know, they would go to vacation on the vineyard every summer.
Wow.
You know, oh, wait, they would summer.
Right.
You know, so like they were the sort of aspirational blacks, you know, the kind of black that I would sort of, you know, I thought of as a unicorn because
right.
I grew up in North.
Right.
So I, whenever I have encounters with them, I'm always a little bit like, oh, right. Like, oh, man, if y'all had met me 10, 15 years sooner, like we would not have been cool.
A different relationship.
Like y'all would have been judging me really hard.
Wow.
Maybe, you know, so I do have that experience of being able to sort of see
both sides.
And when I was writing Constance as the hard one conclusion, the hard one answer to your question. when I was crafting Constance, I was really trying to imagine what it must be like to have only experienced, you know, that aspirational black living, you know,
right.
And what they must think of us. And I still identify, it doesn't matter how much money I make now, it doesn't matter how nice a car I drive or how nice a house I have now. It doesn't matter, like I'm always gonna feel a little bit like that dirty little hood girl, you know? Like I'm always gonna feel that way. And so I really, just wanted to honor both
experiences.
Yeah.
When I was gonna ask, like when you were talking about that, because you kind of touched on it, like do you feel a sense of duality between these two experiences? Like how do you grapple with that?
I grapple with it by writing plays.
That's fair.
No, really, like that's really the only way that I'm able to process the experience and and shine a light and hope. This is gonna sound so cheesy, but like build a bridge. Maybe I really hope that I get people thinking about like, hey, you know that person that you've been judging for being too bougie or for being a sellout or whatever. Or hey. On the other side, you know, that person that you've been judging for being, you know, real ghetto and, you know, they're actually super loyal and like have deep thoughts or, you know, so just getting people to meet in the middle and getting folks to understand that like whatever class markers there are on a person, they're still a fucking person.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And they have feelings, they have thoughts, they have ambitions, they have, you know, fears,
right.
They have
dreams.
They have all that stuff and you know, it shouldn't matter like if you say ask or I keep coming back to that, but
right.
like because it's just so it's such a shorthand for
that difference.
That shouldn't matter.
Well, and I love hearing you talk about this too, because there was such specificity between the two experiences of like when Constance was saying her daughter told her she was like colonizing language, or like there was something about like
her brain had been colonized.
Yeah, but because of the language,
because
she
speaks proper English,
right?
Like,
which is like, yeah. But I mean, I hear there's plenty of people where they there's plenty of black people who say their families say they sound white because they use proper grammar, and it's like you can be black and use proper grammar.
Yeah.
Like it's so interesting. But there was even things in the play like. When Constance was saying her husband didn't drink the last of the milk or the last of the OJ. And it was so specific, which I loved.
That was absolutely my experience. Because after I grew up in Newark, for the most part, when I got that scholarship to go to that school.
Oh, yeah.
I moved in with a wealthy white family. And I lived with them all through high school, all through college.
Oh, wow.
And... the mom was the one who pointed it out that I would do that.
Really?
Yeah. That I would leave just a little bit. Just a little bit of, and it really, and she didn't really understand. She was just like, this is annoying, right? Like, stop doing it. You know, that was sort of her. But it really, I was like, wow, yeah, that is weird that I do that. Like, why do I do that? And it's because I grew up, like, I spent the earlier part of my life, like, in a house where it was really important to make things last because you didn't know when the next trip to the grocery store was going to be, you know? Like, you didn't know.
Yeah.
Like when you're going to be able to afford another carton of milk. So,
right.
Make it last, you know.
What was the transition like to boarding school too? Because I'm like, this just seems jarring to be like to go away and live with a bunch of people. Like, I mean, I guess it's like college, but what was that experience like?
Yeah, it's weird. Well, it wasn't a boarding school. Like, I moved in with this family.
Oh,
yeah. So like they just hosted me in their home. I thought it was a boarding school when I accepted the scholarship because I was like, whatever, it has multiple buildings. Like, yeah.
Right.
If it has multiple buildings, if it has a campus, then clearly it's a boarding school.
Yes.
Right. Not so much. So, yeah, I was like freaking out. Didn't know what I was going to do. And this family that was associated with the program stepped up. It's a longer story. I'm not going to get into it. But like they stepped up and said, hey, actually, you can come live with us. We already have two daughters who go there. And yeah. And, you know, we have the resources. So come stay with us because I sure as heck wasn't going to be able to afford a bus pass to get there. You know, like there were just so many things that I wouldn't have been able to go if they hadn't invited me to come live with them. But at that point, my life had already, I was already sort of like, I had been passed around already.
Gotcha.
Because the woman that I was living with in Newark wasn't even my biological mother.
Oh, okay.
She took me in when I was like 3 or 4. So at that point, it was just like, okay, I'm going to live with another family. Like,
yeah.
Oh, and this one has money. Okay, cool.
Right. Did you feel isolated? I don't know.
Oh man, when I got there, I was not prepared.
Yeah.
And I don't think I had the language to really, or the wherewithal to like really like, process what I was going through at the, but it was culture shock. Like it was really, I felt like I was colonizing another planet. Like going to that school, being amongst the daughters, because it was an all-girls school of all these sort of very conservative, wealthy white people who, you know, have a certain idea about, again, what girls like me must be like. They almost got me kicked out of that school for nothing.
What?
Yeah, because some parent swore up and down that at some dance, there was a school dance or whatever, and she just swore up and down that I was on drugs.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Because I was upset because the DJ was ignoring all the black girls. That's a whole other thing. But you know, after hearing Come On Eileen get played for the third time, like all the black girls were really pissed off, you know, because we wanted it to some reggae, some
right.
hip hop, something, right? Just one song. Just give us one song. It could be Vanilla Ice. We don't care. Like, you know, just something with a beat, you know?
Right, right.
So we were upset. I got upset. And I guess some parent saw me and was like, oh, she's clearly clearly like a drug induced rampage here. Like,
oh my
this
God.
Is, you know, and she literally petitioned other parents.
What?
Yeah. Petitioned other parents, to get me kicked out of the school. And they presented their petition to the head of the school, who then called my white mom. She's my mom now. Like,
aww.
This woman is like my straight mom.
Yeah.
So. But they petitioned, the head of school called her and said, so listen, we
Are
have some
kidding?
Concerned parents. I have this petition in front of me. Can you just come in for a meeting and address their concerns, blah, blah. So she went in there. I had no idea that any of this was going on, by the way.
Oh my
she
God.
Totally kept this from me for like 10 years.
Wow.
Right? I didn't know about it until years after the fact. But she went into that office. Not a single one of those other parents showed up. And she was sitting there staring at the headmistress like, where are they?
Right.
Yeah, they're not here because they know that that's some racist bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you kick my daughter out of this school, like, I will hit you with a lawsuit so fast it'll make your head spin. And I was like,
yes, Mom.
Yes. Right? So,
wow.
Yeah, I almost got kicked out of that school. Because
holy
meanwhile,
shit.
Like, I couldn't even, like, I still can't even, like, take an Advil without, like, reading the label. You know, like, drugs were just not my thing. I had too much to lose. Like, I was a scholarship kid, you know? Like, I'm not trying to mess around. I was all about the dare and the say no to drugs. Just say no, you know? I was so straight edge, like, it wasn't even funny. And their daughters, meanwhile, were, like, wild as fuck, you know? They're out there drinking and, you know, raiding their parents' cabinets for prescription whatever's, and it's just,
and yet they were blaming you.
But yeah, but I was the problem. So yeah, which is why I write plays now, because I'm like, y'all need to understand where we're coming from, and you need to understand that, like, whatever idea that you have in your head about how I must be is likely wrong. And I'm going to need you to adjust your expectations and to behave accordingly.
Hey, you know, another moment I loved in Proof of Love was, and it got some, it got plenty of chuckles when I was there, was the MTC, not to put MTC on blast, but like when Constance is interacting with a white woman in the bathroom at an MTC show, and she's like, is this your first time seeing a show? And she's like, is this your first time seeing a black woman? Like, because it was so, it was, it, I feel like it explains exactly what you just described at the school of, like, white people in a general sense, of course, but like,
love to make assumptions about who we must be
and write the whole narrative of yourself for narrative.
And I'm like, no, you don't get to do that.
No.
And you don't get to, you know, you don't get to not hire me based on your narrative. You don't get to decide that, you know, your son shouldn't be dating me based on your narrative. You know, you don't get to, like, I don't call the police on me. Because of whatever that narrative that you have written in your head. Like, I'm going to need you to come see this play and get a different narrative, get the true
narrative.
Get the true story, right?
Yes. No, absolutely. I feel that. And that's what I think is so exciting about Proof of Love in particular, is like, these characters, even though we just see one, like, you, the way you write it, you describe all of these characters as, like, containing multitudes, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you're not going to distill us and essentialize us into one thing, you know, and we get to see these different experiences, which is really exciting, you know? And I was curious, too, which you touched on a little bit, that you had done work with this for Lynn, but how was it writing this play, since it's going to be an audio version through Audible, and it's on stage.
Yeah, so cool. Oh, yes. Okay, so when Audible, first of all, I knew about this Emerging Writers Fund that they had. I didn't actually know that it was Emerging Writers Fund. For whatever reason, I just saw $5 million, and I thought, oh, well, clearly they're going to give that. They're going to tap all the Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, the, they're going to tap the like, really established, you know, brand name writers. And and I was like, oh man, I'd love to get a piece of that. That's never gonna happen, whatever. So I was shocked, so pleasantly surprised when my agent,
I love it,
was like, so hey, listen, Audible wants to meet with you to discuss the possibility of a commission. I was like, word. So yeah, I sat down with them. They were like, ah, yeah, this is a good match. Like, we're Nork, you're Nork. Like, you know, we really think that you know, we like your work. Amelia LaPenta, who used to work at McCarter, I guess had read some of my plays there, and then remembered me, maybe. I don't even know. Like, I'm still trying to figure out, like, what what, you know, algorithm, you know,
how it all led to it, but it led away.
So I was still trying to figure that out, but yeah, for whatever reason, they said, yeah, we want to give you this. And they were like, write a radio play. And I said, okay, great, and we'll put it on Audible. And I was like, this is awesome.
So cool.
So I double the surprise when they said, and also, you know, we want to put it up live. We think we want to do a live staged version of it also, which presented a whole other challenge,
right?
You know, because I had written it specifically for the radio, as the New York Times pointed out today. when I was there yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
There, which was basically like, oh, yeah, it was really well acted, really well directed. The writing, maybe it'll work better as a radio play. And I'm like, oh, wow.
But so you read reviews usually?
I do.
Yeah.
They care. I don't know who I pissed off at the times, man, but they kill me every time.
Really?
They are like the most powerful non-ally I've ever had. They're not an enemy because they're just doing their job, you know, like whatever. But I really feel like, I don't know, like I'm like not one of their sort of ordained few. I'm done picking on the times. I'm done picking on the times.
But that brings up an interesting point too of like,
I feel like that I have so much, I don't even know if I'm gonna be able to get this out so in one go, so I have to repeat myself. But like, one, when we talk about diversity, inclusion, representation, like we're saying with colorblind casting, like it's not just about casting Black people in something and making it work. It's not like we need representation and inclusion everywhere in the ecosystem of theater.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe they just don't get it because they're too lazy to do the work. Like, so put someone in there who knows what's going on. Okay. I'm picking on the New York Times now. Don't come after the New York Times. But you know what I mean? It's like, but do you think about that as a writer? Like when you're,
I mean, not really. Not when I'm writing.
Yeah.
It really doesn't hit me until we're in production, usually around like tech week. That I'm just sort of where I'm watching it, and then I'm like, oh, I should try to maybe watch this like, you know, like a regular audience person who hasn't seen it yet, you know, would watch it, or like the way a critic would watch it, the way a critic who is disinclined to, I don't know, process stories that are about this, you know, like what would they have to say about this kind of a thing? And it doesn't occur to me to do that really until like pretty late in the process, but it is what it is.
It might be better that way though, because I would hate for you to feel restricted by that.
Yeah, no, I never do that. Yeah. I write what moves me.
Absolutely.
And if it comes with a condition the way it did with Audible of, hey, this needs to work in audio format.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one or two characters preferably, have at it, you know. If it comes with conditions like that, then yeah, all right, cool. But I'm not then going to put on top of that, you know, what would the Times say about it?
Right.
Or like, you know, the Times, like that's a, like I haven't had like five different reviewers tear me to pieces from the Times. But yeah, it's I got enough to worry about. I don't need to.
Right.
You don't need to
be inhibited by that.
Yeah, no, because I can't figure out what they. Man, the last play actually, the one that just closed, Shirley Goodness and Mercy, to which they actually invited their one Black reviewer. So
wait, New York Times has a Black reviewer?
I know. It was news to me too. But yeah. Maya. Phillips, I think that's her name.
A Black woman?
Yes! Maya Phillips came to see my show. I was like a little heartbroken because I was like, oh. Her chief complaints were like, oh, the scenes are too short. And also she doesn't talk enough about race, issues of race and class. And, you know, she touches on things briefly, but doesn't really delve deeply into them. And I'm like, that's because I'm just trying to show these people living their lives. And, you know, in over the course of living your life, you don't really get the opportunity. So I said, okay, whatever. Which is why it was extra aggravating to read the review of Proof of Love, which was like, I just don't buy that she would monologue. Through this experience, like I don't think she would have the inclination or the time to soliloquize.
That's so bizarre to me because I was thinking the whole time, this makes sense.
Like, oh, well, not only that, but it's just the juxtaposition of those two particular reviews back to back of like, oh, her scenes are too short. I wish she would delve deeper into these issues of race and class. And then the very next review is literally of the play that is really just a woman. One long scene of someone processing, amongst other things, amongst other personal things, issues of class and race, right? In depth. to have a like damned if you do, damned if you don't
moment.
It was a little frustrating, but what can you do?
But that's the thing too. Like, you shouldn't have to, just because you're a black female playwright does not mean you always have to have characters that are like struggling, or there's that their struggles don't have to revolve around being black or being a woman, you know?
I know.
New York Times, do you know? That's interesting. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about too lately of like, you kind of touched on this earlier too, but the grouping or the kind of comparing of black playwrights currently, you know, because I feel like, like, of course there's have been black playwrights making dope ass theater for a long time, but lately it seems like, especially off Broadway, perhaps, and maybe social media is bringing more attention to it, but it's like, people are talking, like, buzzing about the young black playwrights of today.
Yeah.
And it's like, but it does create this weird, from my perspective, I feel like there might be, it creates a weird tension of who's writing black stories correctly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And what audience are they appealing to? You know?
Like, I don't know, we can't solve the problem tonight, but it is just an interesting thing to observe happen.
It is.
You know?
It is.
But I will say, on the flip side, I think it's on your website, or it was an article I was reading, there's this beautiful photo of you, eyes are closed, your hair, I think you must have just flipped your hair. Big smile on your face. You know which photo I'm talking about?
Walter Kurtz. He took that photo.
Shout out to Walter Kurtz. and it seemed like such an expression of joy and of freedom. And I loved it. It just like carefree magic happening. But it made me wonder, what does freedom mean to you? Which I know is a loaded ass question.
Yeah, it is. And I want to say, that freedom is not giving a solitary fuck, like what other people think about your art. But that's kind of, that kind of swims upstream of the whole point, I think, anyway, of art, especially playwriting, which is to like plug as many people as possible into your experience of a thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so of course I care what other people think, because that, I think, is my job as an artist, is to try to move as many people as possible in some way, you know? And I think to dismiss that, or to hope for something that runs opposite of that, is to not really be an artist. Like, I can't stand self-indulgent pieces of work, you know, theater, or you know, where it's like that don't invite the audience in, or that alienates an audience, or you know, like, I don't like that. Like, I don't like experiencing that kind of theater as a person, you know, as an audience member. And I don't like, it just wouldn't occur to me to try to create that, you know? So I would like to say that, like, not giving, I don't give a fuck. That's my freedom, you know?
Right.
But it's not. So I guess it would just be, I don't know, freedom would be not worrying about whether critical reviews, or the fact that I haven't won a Pulitzer by the time I'm a certain age, or, you know, not worrying about whether those things will affect my ability to keep creating art.
Okay.
I think that's really what my chief concern is, yeah. you know, of yeah. like just, I really don't want to slow down to the point of stopping. And I feel like, I feel a sense of duty almost, mm-hmm. especially to the people and the companies who invest in me as an artist. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel more actually disappointed for a company when, like, I don't fetch great reviews or something, you know? Like, I feel like I really want those companies to feel really proud to be associated with me, mm-hmm. you know? To feel like they backed a winner before she was even a winner, you know? And yeah. It hurts when I can't do that for them, mm-hmm. when I can't, like, blow up their profile, mm-hmm. you know? I'm thinking, like, as long as we're talking about dope Black writers, like, the way, like, Brandon Jacobs Jenkins did mm-hmm. for, and Jackie said, they got two right. Pulitzer Prize winners, you know, Soho Rep.
Soho Rep, right.
Yeah, the way, like, they seem to have a sort of, I don't know, radar that, mm-hmm. And they have these sort of beacons out mm-hmm. there, these artist beacons that, are, you know, can draw the right kind of attention to their company. Mm-hmm. Which I feel like must be such a great feeling for, like, Jackie and Brendan. You know, it must feel it's that return of on investment thing. You know, it's that I don't like feeling like there are these people and these entities that are pouring all these resources into me and I'm not getting them there. Like returns. Right. I'm not delivering, right? Like, I feel that is really where sort of my sense of failure and shame lie. Mm. You know, like that's what cuts me deeply, because I know I can't, you know, not everybody's gonna like my work, and that's mm. you know, okay, like, I come to accept that I'm just not your cup of tea. That's, you know, that's, that's okay. But the people for whom it does work, you know, the people who were able to plug in, like, mm-hmm. that fills me up. That's yes. like, yeah, okay, good. At least it worked for some people.
Right.
So that part, the audience part, I'm like, okay, as long as the majority of the people out there who came to see it, like, enjoyed it or took something away from it, like, that's cool. So that part takes care of itself. I'm not really worried about that. Mm-hmm. But what I do worry about is, you know, the companies who see something in me, you know,
I would hope that theaters are supposed to be, you know, about creating meaningful art and moving art, even if it affects one person, which your work affects more than one person. But you know what I mean? Like, I think this day and age, we all know that art is so subjective, and to just pin so much on reviews isn't like the new model anymore.
Yeah. But reviews, awards, like, whatever, like, all that stuff.
All these awards. Hello.
Yeah. But it's, you know what I mean, though. Like, yeah. And those companies, I'm not mad at them either, because, like, they got to keep the lights on, mm-hmm. you know, they got to get butts in the seats. They got to get funding. They, you know, and I'm sure it helps to have a Pulitzer Prize winner or two in the roster, you
right,
know?
Right.
So I can't even be mad at that, but it does, that keeps me up at night, you know?
Yeah.
It the worry that pretty soon opportunities might start drying up because I haven't been delivering the way people hoped.
It's a particular pressure.
Yeah.
That I feel like a lot of people don't understand.
Mm.
Man. Well, I believe in you, if that means anything. But
it does.
But I do know what you mean. And I feel like that freedom that we're talking about of being able to continue to make art
mm-hmm.
and trying not to worry about that is something to strive for, that type of freedom. And if y'all would love to go check out
Chisa's Proof of Love, which I highly recommend. You can get tickets at
www.nytw.org.
The last two questions to wrap up the podcast are, one, besides Proof of Love, if you could recommend a piece of Black art for our listeners to take in, whether it's a book or a musical album or a theater piece or a film, what would it be?
Oh, man.
I know. It's really not a fair question.
It's not. Especially because I haven't been able to see much of anything lately. But
it could be an old school thing. It could be a throwback.
Oh, throwbacks. Okay. Book. Okay. Yeah. So if you haven't read Becoming by Michelle Obama, please yes. do that.
I'm halfway through. I know. She has got me to cry on a train, on yes. a plane. I'm like, Michelle.
And it's not like you don't know how, like, how it ends right. or whatever, you know, but you're still, I was up in my feelings, yes. like, on the plane, on the, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, like, that was the last, anyway, book that I read that really, like, just was such an inspiration. Kia Carthron's Castle Cross the Magnet Carter.
I don't know it. Oh, my goodness. I'm going to write it down, though.
Here is she's a playwright. She's a dope playwright
mm-hmm.
who wrote a novel. Not just a novel, but, like, an epic novel. It okay. is, like, it's long. I'm not going to lie. It's, like, it's like 800 pages long. Ooh. So if you're the type who you're, like, you get to the end of a book and you're like, oh, I can't believe it's ending. You know, you will love this because it's super long.
Right.
So even if you're a fast reader, it should last you a little while. But every page is so, it's so juicy and so, I loved it. I can't say enough yes. about it. And I highly, highly, highly recommend it. Let's see, what else? What have I seen? What have I seen that isn't my place?
You have been focused.
I'll tell you what I'm going to see
yeah, yeah.
that I'm excited about.
Tell me.
I'm really looking forward to Corey Thomas.
Lockdown.
Just saw it. So looking forward yes. to it. I want to see it. I think I'm going to see it on Friday.
Oh, report
am
back.
I seeing it on Friday? Yes.
We just interviewed the director, Kent Gash, last week.
Oh,
It's really powerful.
Yeah. I'm ready. Yes. I'm ready for that. And then what did I see that rocked my? I mean, anything Lynn Nottage.
Yeah. general statement is Lynn Nottage.
Lynn Nottage. Yeah. Lynn Nottage.
Well, so then the second question is, if you could give a shout out to a fellow Black artist, who would it be?
Apart from Lynn Nottage.
Yeah. Apart from Lynn Nottage. I mean, Lynn gets the end all be all shout out.
So many. I just had like 12 spring into my head all at the same time.
Do all 12. Let's do it.
Okay. So, okay. Antoinette Nwandu.
Yes.
Yes. Jackie Sibuzura. I already mentioned her.
Yes.
But she's so dope.
Yes.
I'm going to forget people.
I know.
Shoot.
Another blanket statement. Shout out to everyone. But these are just the ones that just happen to pop into her head right now.
Yes. Yes. Ngozi Anyanwu.
Yes.
Yes.
Jocelyn Biot.
Yes.
Yes.
Podcast alum.
Yes. 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 Keith Joseph Adkins. Mm-hmm. Although I haven't seen, more of his stuff needs to get done. I haven't seen anything of his in a while.
Producers get on
he's
it.
He's so dope. And who else? Who else? I'm like, who else is out there? Now that you ask me, like,
I know. Look,
they're all
look.
Crowding in my head, and they're all bottlenecking right at the
opening the tip of your tongue. Yes, I mean that was a good list. Like, we can keep it at that, and then okay. just basically shout out to everyone.
Yes,
who's shout doing the damn thing?
Who's doing the damn thing? I'm gonna feel so badly because I know I'm gonna talk to somebody who is like,
you didn't shout me. I'm gonna shout out. But this right now, like, we are giving props to everyone, and we can always like. We'll do an Instagram post and have people later, or tweet out people later as you think of them, you know? It was such a pleasure to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. If folks want to follow you on social media so they can follow your journey, how can they do that?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I actually occasionally remember that I have a Twitter account and like post stuff. Let's see. Oh, I have a website, www.chisahutchinson.com.
I like that website. I spent some time on it today.
Oh.
and on Instagram and Twitter, is it just Chisa Hutchinson?
Yep.
What's your name? Perfect.
Instagram actually is Chisa BH.
Chisa BH.
Yeah, there's some imposter person that's like, and I was really irritated because if you search me on Instagram, I don't think they're still on there. But like, if you search me on Instagram, like Chisa Hutchinson 1977 or something was like the first thing to pop up, and I'm like, that's and my picture had my picture and everything. Total imposter. And I was like, who is this person? And some of my friends friended her.
No.
Yes, like thinking that she was me, and I'm like, no, this is so I reported. So
good for you.
I think she's gone now, but I was like, 1977 is not even my birth year.
Can you get it right?
I'm an 80s baby, damn it.
Right.
But yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. This was cool.
Until next time, y'all.